The Incomparable Podcast, Episode 52. August 2011. First Anniversary Edition.
We're back on The Incomparable, and I have reconvened again our book club because this is an anniversary of sorts. This is basically a year almost to the day of the original episode of The Incomparable, and this is indeed Incomparable number 52.
Jason, I didn't get us anything.
The voice you just heard is one of our former podcast members who's come. Dan Morin joins me. He was on that first podcast, and the other participants were on that podcast as well. Glenn Fleischman, welcome back. You've made it a year. Congratulations.
Thank you. Congratulations to you for having the fortitude to do this.
Yes, I quit. This podcast is over.
1 year and we're over.
And also joining us is, as he was on episode one, when we didn't have a name for the podcast, Scott McNulty. Hi, Scott.
Woo! I am so glad that we are the only people that have survived the great incomparable killing.
Yes. Free. Everyone else is dead.
It's unfortunate.
By the way, don't answer your door.
Ding dong.
So in episode one of The Incomparable, we'll always have Zeppelins from August 22nd of 2010. We talked about, among other things, the novel The City in the City by China Mieville, and he's back because we read Embassy Town, which Ooh. Is his latest novel. We all read it. I think it's fair to say that some of us didn't like it very much.
I think that might be more than fair to say.
Heaven forfend.
So this could be good.
I won't tell you my opinion of the book, but my opinion of the marketing of the book is not too high, because everywhere I was reading, you know, I'm a fan of good old China, as I'm going to call him, because I can never pronounce his last name. So I eagerly anticipated the book, and I would read the advance, you know, marketing copy. And everywhere it would say, space opera. Describe this book as a space opera. Now, unless I have no idea what space opera means.
It's actually an opera set in space.
It does Whoa. Feel a little Wagnerian.
Or the marketing people have no idea what they're talking about. Because this, in my limited understanding of the space opera, it generally involves a sweeping story, large battles and things, you know, a grand stage and something big. And this novel can be described as many things, but to paraphrase, I know space operas, and you, Embassy Town, are no space opera.
No, it might be a planet opera. I mean, I think that if you think about all the events that occur in Embassy Town, I was telling my wife this, it feels like in some ways this could have been four novels, because the events on the surface of that planet, it's like, let's demolish an entire culture and then watch as it is sort of rebuilt. There's a lot that happens that completely changes what happens on that planet, but it's certainly not like what I would think of as a space opera, which is this sweeping scope of many planets and battles in space and things. And it's really, there are some scenes in the hyperspace kind of thing called the Immer, and then everything else is on this planet where Embassy Town is.
There's like 5 minutes of space travel.
Instead of being a space opera, it's more like a space Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds song, I think.
I don't even know what that means, but I agree.
So let's start back at the beginning here, which is Embassy Town is a novel that's set in kind of multiple time frames, and then the multiple time frames shift. It's about
you gotta call it the way it is. No, you're right. You're right. It's an accurate description.
The protagonist is a woman named Avis. She's a native, basically, of this planet, which is a has this alien race that lives on it. But there is a place where all of the ambassadors and staff who are not from this alien race live, and it's an air bubble of breathable atmosphere, and that is called Embassy Town. So it is the place where all the aliens live, including the humans, on this planet. And she has a little coming-of-age thing where she's a kid on the planet, and then she learns to be an Immer pilot, which means that she can travel through the stars. And then at a later time, she comes back to the planet, and then the fun begins. Because then there are crazy machinations with ambassadors, and there's a thing called a MIAB, which you find is a message in a bottle.
And just in case you thought Jason might be applying that you go like 200 pages before the fun kicks in, he's totally right.
Does the fun
I'm not even sure it kicks in at 200 pages.
Oh.
And the hosts, the aliens are called the hosts, and they can't understand when people talk, but they can understand when these weird kind of like mentally bonded pairs of people speak simultaneously because the hosts have two mouths, and it's wild. It is a wacky, very original, I thought, premise. But yeah, it is not exactly a quick read to get to the big fight scene.
Well, it's not even important. I don't even know how important that is. It's just what strikes me here is what you said about there being, you know, several different books in here. And I think that's true. And I think all of them get short shrift. Like, none of them are fully fleshed out. And none of them are. It's like every time you think, oh, okay, this is getting someplace interesting, like the rug gets pulled out from under you and you start all over again. And this is tough because he really enjoys dumping people, not just sort of in media res, like in the middle of things, but in terms of like in the middle of these extremely complex environments, right, where you don't necessarily have any idea what's going on. Like, how long does it take you to figure out sort of the central premises of this world and the society they're in? And then no sooner do you sort of start to get a handle on that than you're sucked away into this, you know, into the her career as an Immer pilot, which doesn't last very long and doesn't really seem to have a huge bearing on the rest of the book.
You know, I will say one of the things I appreciate about Mieville and I appreciate about this book is a little bit like Anathem by Neal Stephenson. He's going to set you down in the world and you got to figure it out. And I like that.
I liked Anathem, and I think that's the major difference. Uh-huh. No, I think Stevenson's much better at that, because Mieville, the thing that bothers me about most of his books, and I read all three of the, whatchamacallit, New Crobazon or whatever, the Perdido Street Station.
That's a made-up word. Crobazon?
I read all three of those.
It's not a word.
My point. He just spends so much time saying, like, his whole books are, isn't this weird? Isn't that weird? This guy's got, like, a bug head. Isn't that weird? It's like, it just draws so much attention to itself that it feels like hitting me over the head with a hammer about weirdness. And it's like, it's hard for me to ever get engaged because I feel like I'm constantly being reminded, isn't this weird?
But your point that you just made was that, you know, you have to figure out what the rules of the world are and what some of these words mean. And that didn't bother me. I think your point is much more valid, that as you figure it out, suddenly we are jerked away to yet another angle. So she's growing up and you're like, oh, coming of age in this weird place. No, now she's a pilot and she's got to learn about this weird hyperspace topography, multidimensional topography. Okay, I'm starting to get that. It's Immer, which is the timeless always of the hyperspace, and it's the Etwas or whatever the German word is that they use. I'm starting to get that. But oh, no, now she's back and she's not in the space anymore. She's back on the planet again.
Don't you think that's a device, though?
But it strikes me as a random vomiting of ideas, like, rather than any fully formed coherent narrative.
I think the vomiting is ordered. I wouldn't say random vomiting. I would say a procession of...
I find this emblematic and sort of, you know, endemic to all the stuff that he writes to a certain extent. The sole exception in my experience being The City and the City, which is very, very strange, but I really enjoyed and thought was well constructed and well crafted as a story in a way that this was not.
There's a mainline plot in The City and the City is that you go from one end to the other and there's actually a resolution and you're sort of hitting waypoints along the way.
Plus there's a structure that makes sense, right?
Yeah, which is true of most... I mean, it is true of Perdido Street Street Station has got, it's, you know, it's a rambling thing, but it's not picaresque, right? This is picaresque. This is the definition of picaresque, is that you're walking along and you get to one destination. When you get there, there's not a resolution to the story. It's like, oh, and here's the next story, and let's go on and so forth. So you don't feel like there, he may have intended an arc, but there is no sense of a story arc from through the, there's no through line for this. It reads like five stories that have similar things in common.
The problem with that is that in a picaresque, what keeps you going from story to story is that the characters, you know, usually are engaging, right? And in this, also not. I mean, I honestly found myself not really understanding or caring about Avis.
Well, I didn't understand the whole obsession with establishing that the man she's in love with, they don't have sex, and yet they get married. Like, there's a number of times they, you know, I thought he was going to make a point about, like, interspecies things or the nature of and whatever. And it's like, we tried to do things in bed and it didn't work out. But then we stuck around. He was sort of a weirdo and he was obsessed with language. And so we got married. It's like, why? I don't quite. What's the point of that? Like, where does that fit in?
It's very off cuff. That's still the weirdness, right? Like, yes, isn't this different from the way you do things where you are?
Yes, in this world, marriage means something different. And it's a special contract that can mean many things, including sex or not. Ha ha. How about that? Now let's move on.
Yeah, I've challenged your preconceived notions.
Next.
Check.
That's yes, that would be the Onion version of this story. Is the I challenge your preconceived notions with this and this.
And I have a friend, and she's a robot or an automaton or a computer program with wheels tied to
What's
it.
What's the deal with her?
Yeah, what was the point of that? I don't even understand.
You know, okay, wait. I want to present a counter-narrative to Dan's narrative, which is threatening to overwhelm this podcast, which is there's a lot of stuff in it I quite like. There's a lot of great ideas, and I don't think you're disagreeing with that entirely. It's kind of like, you know, let's say Mievel opened his notebook of things to write books about, and it seems like rather than have a compelling character-driven narrative and through which he can tell a story of a world or even vice versa, it was, I've got a bunch of stuff here that doesn't fit to other books. I'm going to stick it in there, and I will use one character to bind it up. But I mean, like So I liked parts of it, and some of it is very clever. Some of it I found somewhat moving, but then it becomes but it's so conventional for being so weird. The resolution was really rather disappointing, and I think it starts out. I mean, Anthem suffers from this a little bit, where by the time I talk about Anthem as if it rewired my brain. Like, by the time I figured out enough of what was going on to actually understand what was being said in the narrative, I was so far along in that huge book that I didn't worry about some of the plot points and holes. And when I've read it again, I feel it's a little weaker. In this book, it's the same thing. Like, you're being battered back and forth by all these interesting new ideas, some of which are very interesting, some of which are just like, whatever. And then you're like, oh, well, the story in the end is kind of, you know, reason wins. Yay! Why? Yay! And then there's a, you know, irrational guy who shoots. Boo! Boo!
Well, I mean, and in some ways, he was a more interesting character to me. But he goes away for like half the book, and then he comes back, and he's like, "Oh, he's crazy now."
Every Neal Stephenson book has a character like the husband who becomes deranged as the novel goes on. They come back in like the fifth act. You think the book is over, and some guy you haven't seen for like two or three acts who is significant, like was it Raven in Snow Crash, and he's in every one of his books has this. But there's always that's sort of a Stephenson thing, and his best books are the ones in which he doesn't have to pull out some Deus Ex Machina. A character who haven't heard for a while, who's 7 feet tall or whatever.
I'm not saying Stevenson's without his flaws, but
yeah, but I'm saying that I think that that is a typical thing in this book, is that you get this character who shows up rather late after having had a lot of narrative exposition played around him, and then he's sort of forgotten.
Well, but you also know he's coming back, right? Because it's totally foreshadowed with, oh, he went off and no one ever saw him again.
He's in the wilderness doing something.
So I don't know. I found that kind of transparent as a plot. I mean, I you're right, Glenn. There are interesting ideas here. I think a lot of the language stuff, as someone who studied linguistics a little bit and really found it fascinating, there is some really interesting stuff there. But it was hard to get a handle on in a way that worked for the narrative, especially when we had spent so much of the earlier book jaunting around between all these other different. I mean, for example, just there's that whole bit when she's learning to be an Immer pilot about the wreck,
right?
Which is this. I mean, this sort of derelict ship, right? That's out there as like a warning.
It's like half in and half out of space.
Yeah, and there's not really. I Not sure I really understood what the point of that was. It gets mentioned later on, too, but I was like, oh, yeah, that thing.
I think you're supposed to feel that that this planet is out at the end of the world and that beyond lies the great question of these are the most alien aliens and we don't really understand them. And it's almost like they got here by accident and other things have been wrecked. And beyond here, there'd be dragons. We don't know what else is out there past this point.
God, so, that sounds like an interesting book. I wish someone would write that.
Yes. Oh. Well, I thought it was a little more interesting than that. I want to talk about the language because I think he did empty out his sort of sci-fi tropes into this book, but
I picture him shaking a bag into a word processor.
A bag ground, of trope holding.
Ground tropes in a little, like a shaker, like you'd get a red pepper flake in at a pizza parlor. It's the trope shaker. Yeah. You shake it in. But what this book is really about and what he wanted to do was talk about, I guess they call it, linguistic relativity now. Back in my comm major days, it was the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. It's the idea that language and thought are interrelated and that the language you use defines how you think. And that's what this book is about. This book is about a race of aliens who cannot think in anything symbolic. Everything they say is literal. And the advent of these creatures who speak in non-literal terms is, they're confused and they're trying to figure out how to interrelate with the humans, and it leads to all the problems, but it also leads to the resolution in that once they kind of pollute this alien race, they can, you know, the alien race starts to learn how to use symbols. And in fact, even before that, there's some of the aliens who are trying very hard to lie. And there's this whole like liars club where they're trying very hard to say things that are counterfactual because they grasp that there is symbology to be had. And the whole point of the last part of the book, I think, is that the way they change the way they think is entirely based on changing their language into a new language, and they tear down their old culture and bring up this new culture. Now, how interesting that is and how even likely it would be that you'd have aliens who have this kind of way of thinking, I don't know. But I thought it was, as an old comm major, I thought it was really interesting to have all that talk about similes, and she's a simile. She has to act something out, and then they use it and say, oh, you're like the girl who ate what she was given. And there's the guy who dies who swam every day. So he's the boy who swam every day and then he dies. And they're like, he's the boy who swam every day, but then he died. They have to be that literal with it. And I thought that was fascinating.
And how many seconds were you into the novel, or how many minutes were you into the novel when you read that part where you thought, Darmak and Jalad at Tanagra?
It's not the same.
It's not the same, though. You're right, because they're recounting.
Well, it's an inverse sort of in some
ways. It is. The idea here is that what if there was a race that can't make symbols, that can't think anything but literal facts, and then basically the humans come in and completely ruin their entire civilization, destroy their planet, and only out of the rubble are they able to kind of have a rebirth as a race that can think symbolically.
Basically, we suck. I mean, I like that. I really disliked the whole trope about, like, or the whole section about the, you know, there's this special ambassador who gets everybody high with his words. I don't know. That totally fell flat for me, maybe just because it felt like a generic science fiction-y plot, and they sort of allude to the fact that this is part of this like intrigue by the world that we're sort of a colony of, but it didn't.
Right, they want to sabotage things.
Yeah, I mean, because that all gets backloaded into why they're doing this, it feels very like very vague and very, you know, without purpose, sort of.
And again, it's the too many, you know, not enough space for too many ideas problem, right? I mean, if you could do a whole story about the kind of colony intrigue among the ambassadors and the fact that they're so far away from where they're supposed to be, what they're supposed to be a colony of, that they sort of have broken off and the other government wants to reinforce its authority over them. I mean, there's a story there, right? Except it's just sort of sketched out briefly, and then it's sort of, oh, well, there we go. Let's move on.
A lot of the China Meville stuff, a lot of my problems with him can sort of be lumped under the category of trying too hard. I think he just, it sometimes his all of his writing reads just like he's trying too hard to impress somebody. And that bothers me.
Yeah, this is why The City and the City works so well, is it's much more spare. It backs off. It sort of it's sort of, I mean, from that very first bit in The City in the City where there, it's a crime scene and they're out there and the detective looks up and he sees a woman walking across and then he realizes he has to unsee her as she does him. And you're like, what is that? And he doesn't explain it. And there's not all this stuff and things are just a little off. And then it slowly, you know, sort of irises open as you go through the story, but it's very minimal.
And it works because it's also hooked on a plot that a shape or a structure that you understand, right? There's a murder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've got a detective and like that, that at least gives you an entry into the plot and you can deal with the fact that there are weird things going on somewhere else because you sort of have that to cling to until you sort of get your feet and figure out what's going on in this world. Whereas in this one, if that structure was ostensibly like, it's a space opera, it doesn't really work as that. Like, to me, that structure totally fell flat.
It's not a space opera.
Not a space opera.
Not a space opera.
Scott, you didn't tell us what you thought of the book. What, can you share a little bit now? Can you reveal the secret?
Can you open the envelope and tell us what's in it now, Scott?
Well, other than reading the whole book and expecting some kind of space battle to happen, given all the marketing, and then being very disappointed at the end because there were no space.
I thought the man in the astronaut suit with the sword and the laser on the cover was really unfair.
It was just misleading is all it was. That being said, besides that, my space opera disappointment, I was intrigued by the idea that I had no idea what was going on for a large part of the book. And I think that that was, I don't know if this is me projecting onto what China Miéville was trying to do, but the aliens in the book are presented as so alien that the people on the planet just can't understand them. And so I thought that he was trying to replicate that, to have the reader go through that similar experience by just being completely confused by the book for a vast majority of it.
Mission accomplished.
You did you did get that feeling that humans were living at the mercy of these strange aliens and nobody understands them, and if the air bubble goes away tomorrow, we all die. And right. Living in that environment, like there's a really evocative scene early on where the kids play how far you can get out of the air bubble. Mm-hmm. And how far you can touch out of the air bubble, and then like a kid collapses and almost gets brain damaged, and the aliens have to bring him back in. It's
good times.
You know, that was kind of awesome, actually. So it was evocative that way.
And I remember early on in the book, I was reading it, and he talks about, I guess one of the characters is looking at the cityscape, right? And he talks about she's looking at these factories, and she's like, oh, and the factories were grazing. And I was like, what? How do factories graze? It was like, I don't understand what I'm reading. Did I have a stroke is what I wanted to know.
It's a linguistic stroke. I like reading something in which I am somewhat unmoored. Like, there's something at this point, especially in science fiction, I think we talked about this on a previous podcast. Extensive fantasy reader Dan Morin noted that we were impressed about something. He said, you know, he'd felt like he'd seen it before in probably more extensive fantasy reading than maybe the rest of us had, or he felt it was more commonly expressed ideas. And I think I feel in the sci-fi realm, you know, I've been reading some of the new weird stuff. I've been reading a lot of compilations, anthologies. This podcast has really provoked me to open up a lot of very contemporary sci-fi reading that I think I'd walked away from, including some, you know, like Ian Banks and some of the space opera that is out there now that truly is space opera. And it's hard to find new ideas. You know, sometimes I'll read stuff that's 80 years old and I feel like it has newer ideas than anyone's exploring today. So I respect and love the idea that I can open up a book like Embassy Town and be baffled and confused and hope that the author is going to take me in hand at some point or give me the tools to understand it. And that's sort of a marvelous thing. And that's one of his characteristics, is that you really have to stumble around his world before you figure out what it is. In this case, you're like, oh, well, huh, you know, that didn't turn out to be so interesting after all, did it?
I just wish it was moored to a better story, I guess, yeah. Is what I feel like. Yep. You can do that. I think you can do that and still tell an interesting and engaging narrative.
Agreed.
I just don't think happened here.
But I don't think the story matters in this book. I think it, and the characters really don't matter. I think what he was doing is this kind of rumination.
Also, the readers don't matter.
Well, the readers probably don't matter either. I mean, he's
you
at
the
point.
You just put the book on your desk and just let it sit. Let it
no,
be.
But you know, there is something to be said. China Miéville is at the point in his career, right, where he can basically write whatever he wants. So I don't think he really cares what readers are getting out of this book. I think he just wanted to have an exercise and think about language. And if you look at it in that kind of rubric, I think the book is successful. If you're looking at it as I want to read an entertaining story, maybe you should not read this book, because the story is the weakest element, I think, of the whole thing.
No, it's about there are a lot of ideas. There's some beautifully written passages. But I think that's absolutely, and I really enjoyed it, but I think that's absolutely fair that the story isn't what it's about. And although on a grand scale, I think the story could have been much more interesting than it was, which goes to Dan's point of how, you know, there were more interesting things here than maybe that I imagined as I was reading it than are actually on the page, which I don't think I can say he evoked that. I think it was more like I was kind of anticipating where I thought it would go, and it didn't. But it was, you know, the ideas are really strong. The writing in large sections is beautiful, and I had a great time reading it because the ideas were so weird. And but it wasn't about loving the characters, and it wasn't about having it be a gripping, you know, a gripping overarching story.
Well, and they in the little plot devices they kept going through, and like, for example, you've got this strange ambassador again. And at some point, they allude to the fact that one of the guys in that pair, you know, because this is, they're a weird pair because they're not like raised from youth together, and they're not like clones exactly or whatever. And then they mention that just like this one, you know, one of the two of the pair is just like, oh, he's, you know, empathic or whatever. And it's like, well, that was, they have those. We're like 400 pages into this book. We're introducing an entirely new plot element, it felt like. But it just sort of gets thrown by the wayside again. There's just, again, too much. Too much. It needed to be simplified. I think it needed a more discreet thrust of, you know, what are you talking about, rather than going off every which way.
An article I read about China Mieville said that he wants to write a novel in every genre. And
I think he just did.
Romantic comedy.
That was very good. That took a minute.
You know, this was his space opera. This was his, you know, sci-fi, hard sci-fi novel, or whatever, however you want to call it. And
this wasn't,
I read
even
that,
hard sci-fi.
And I read that. Well, whatever it is, this is his of that. How about that?
I don't know what this. This is just regular
like sci-fi novel. So this
I was going to make a joke about him writing a western, and I realized, oh, I actually read the book that he wrote. That was probably a western. It wasn't very good.
See, so he wants to write a book in every genre, and this is his sci-fi. And I feel like, because of that, that's why we got the emptying out his bag of ideas that he wanted to use in a sci-fi novel, and just poured them all in here. Because some other writer, and perhaps a less ambitious writer, would have taken these ideas and said, "I'm going to write a 7-book series set in the Immerverse, and it's going to be this is going to be over here, and there's going to be a thing on the planet, and then there's going to be the story of the hosts, and that'll be, you know, a trilogy about that." And instead, he's like, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm just the one. Let's just stick it all in there." And that's why it feels the way it does.
And there's something admirable about undermining the expectations. Totally. I agree with that. And I think that he did try to do that. I think we differ on how successful
I suppose we do.
This was a book.
So a question I have for you guys is, how do you picture the hosts? What do you think they look like?
I can tell you how I pictured them. And maybe Scott might be the one who actually finds this most interesting. I kind of picture them like there's a creature in Dungeons and Dragons called the Beholder, which is like this floating fleshy orb with a big eye. And I pictured it kind of looking like one of those, but with a pair of wings or something. I had a very hard time, because every time he would add another feature in there, like, it seemed like their descriptions were doled out piecemeal, right? It felt to me very much like at various points he would refer to various features, and you'd be like, whoa, these guys have like feet? Hold on, I got to rethink this.
So like a beholder with feet.
It was constantly changing. Wings. That was the trouble I had. When they were first introduced, that was how I pictured them. And then as I continued reading through the book, they kept adding features that were at odds with that picture. And so I ended up with just like, I have no idea what these look like.
I can't remember. Do they have eyes, or they have eye wings?
They have like eye stalks.
Eye stalks. That's it. Okay.
Eye stalk. That's a lesser known Asimov book.
So, Scott, what did you think?
I saw them as just big beetles, I guess, which is kind of lame. But that's
George, John.
Yeah, exactly. A giant Ringo is what I.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Beetles. What about you, Glenn?
I was thinking big bugs, sort of like more like mosquitoes with long proboscises and proboscis, and but like weird flippy eyes.
Yeah, I thought it was Zorak from Space Ghost.
Oh.
Yes, I think you're right, Jason.
Yeah. Yeah, Zorak, the band leader from Space Ghost. That's, I pictured a whole planet of Zoraks tearing their hearing limbs off in order
that's
to deafen
good.
Themselves, and then they go that, to war.
That's a planet I would like to visit.
Planet of Zoraks?
Yes.
As long and our protagonist is Space Ghost. See, he could have written that. That would have been a space opera.
I would have read that. I think I would have liked that better.
Well, you read this, though, Dan.
You read
see?
This, exactly.
Damn it!
Ah.
You can't unread
that's
it.
That's how he gets you.
Oh, that's for China Meville's next book, which will be all about unreading things.
China Meville wants to write a book about talk shows. That's the next genre.
Oh, wait.
So perhaps.
Scott, has he written a book yet about 19th century detectives in New York?
No, no.
He has not. But then it would be really weird, so I wouldn't like his, I'm sure.
No,
if he writes a book about,
way,
if he writes
no
a book
Zeppelins.
About unreading, does that mean that we lose the knowledge of all the other books he's written?
Please, please, oh. Please, please. Oh, sorry. That was mean.
That was mean.
I'm sorry.
He's a large man, and he can beat you up.
Wait, wait. He has written a book about unreading. That's what Kraken is about.
I would see... Now, okay, now, Glenn, tell me. Because I've had Kraken on my list for a while, and in fact, I tried to get it out of the library, and through a mishap, didn't end up with it. But
What was the mishap?
No, I was out of town, and it appeared while I was out of town, so I could not retrieve it in time. Now, I want to know, do you think, based on my... history with China Meville, my personal history with him, clearly. I liked The City and City, did not care as much for Embassy Town. Do you think I would enjoy Kraken?
I think I can't tell you for sure. I will tell you Kraken has a much Kraken is a story that has a plot that is like a railroad train barreling down, 80 miles an hour in the track, even when it's on the siding. Like you're going along the track and you're like ka-thunk, 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 oh shit. So even when it's ridiculous, the plot keeps advancing. And at one point there's literally almost a speed-like thing in which they're in a vehicle with like a guy with a living tattoo on his back that's driving like all through London and they can't really stop because they'll be tracked and there's people who talk to the earth and it's crazy, but it's not shambolic like the Embassy Town where it's all kinds of things all over the place. They don't seem to relate. Like Kraken is sort of a rollicking tale and you got to stick with it, but there's like consistent things that happen. There's sort of magic. There's some crazy stuff. And like one of the bits I love is that, the ocean, like the actual ocean, has an embassy. It's a house that's like full of water and fish. And like you can go to it, but it's sort of, you have to sort of find it.
Someone
it's like,
call Aquaman.
Exactly.
Get Emperor Aquaman on the
but
phone.
It's very, Kraken is very Cthulhu-esque, very, very Lovecraftian in some ways, like that there are horrible, giant, inconceivably vast forces.
Cthulhu-esque, as in one of the books that was written by Mr. Cthulhu.
Mr.
Have
Cthulhu
you read those? Those are
and
really,
his traveling circus. Good.
They got a lot of consonants.
I read yes. one and it opened a portal to another realm, so I stopped.
Well, I mean, I'm intrigued because, based on the little bit that I've read and what you said, it sounds kind of Neil Gaiman-ish to a certain
yeah, it's
point.
Definitely like, definitely very Neil Gaiman-ish relative to his other works. There's a story that's told beginning to end, and there is a deus ex machina at the end.
I do like stories when I read books.
Stories. Amateur.
Stories are a crutch for the uneducated readers.
There are some supremely evil characters, and I kind of like evil characters that are just so... They're happily evil. They commit horrible, horrible acts for the pure joy of it, and there's something so creepy about that. These sort of... It reminds me, actually, American Gods, but the sequel, Anasazi Boys, or Anansi Boys, right? Anansi Boys, much more a feeling of that, especially with some of the really evil parts of it. But I know, I think Kraken is a much better book than Embassy Town. It's not full of nearly as many ideas, and it's clearly written to be like part of a series. It's got a detective story in it, too. I mean, it's really, at some level, there's these guys from a sort of supernatural detective force that's part of the London Metropolitan Police Force. Apparently,
the more you tell me about this, the more I want to read it.
Good. That's the
maybe I'll
definition
go do
of a,
that.
That's the definition of a good book. The thing is, I was going to say like this, it's a... it's a rambling story, but it's rollicking. So, like, it runs all over the place, but there's always somebody chasing the hero who is sort of not intended to be a hero, and there's a lot of misdirection, but the misdirection winds up being played out as opposed to frustrating you.
All right, so you can read that while I check out Unlondon, which is his young adult novel that he wrote right before The City in the City, which is supposed to be quite good and won a few awards. And I know that's going to be next up on my wife's reading list because I think she was intrigued by the idea that he did a YA novel that's about it's Unlondon is the name of it, but it's Unlondon. It's a nonsensical mirror version of London that these girls travel to. So it's like The City in the City for kids.
You know, for kids.
Only a little existential horror. Just a little bit of existential horror.
I feel like I come away from this sounding like a hater.
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll be John Syracuse for this evening. I think that he is I don't think he's a bad writer. I mean, I think I find his stuff intriguing. I don't find it enjoyable, if that's a distinction I can make.
I can see that.
I can see that, too.
You know, maybe that's a failing on my part, but...
He's challenging. He's a very challenging writer. And I think he's a very good writer, but I'm not sure if he's everybody's cup of tea, right? I mean, I can see that.
He's certainly not everybody's cup of tea.
No, and I'm not trying to
there's
say
some ground up bits of glass in the teacup, so...
That's
and
not
the teacup is made
tea.
Of a moose's is... head.
And there's no tea.
There's something almost, but not entirely, unlike tea.
So a moose head full of glass. Okay. That explains why I don't care for it. I don't say that to say I dislike, you know, challenging writers or I don't like people who challenge me. I mean, I quite enjoyed, I think, you know, Anathem was brought up as a corresponding or a similar book. I really enjoyed Anathem. But something about Meville's, I think, you know, especially with his earlier stuff, which I think was... very widely liked because it was so off-putting in some ways, right? It was kind of, you know, almost Brechtian in its sort of like alienation techniques that I think that was, you know, oh, look, this is a breath of fresh air. It's something totally new. It's not like anything before.
Yeah.
And maybe I felt like it was too alienating to the point of not having any ability to get immersed in it. And maybe I prefer books that you can get a little more immersed in, that you have a sort of grounding in. And I feel like he enjoys very much pulling the rugs out and maybe just a little too much for me.
So we've had a lot of different opinions about Embassy Town, but I would like to know, and we can go around the horn.
Zorak from Space Ghost is my answer.
Excellent. That's your answer to everything.
And a good answer it is.
I asked him what he wanted for lunch one day, and he says Zorak from Space Ghost.
He's delicious.
I got
mustard.
Him a praying mantis for lunch.
Let the man ask his question.
Go ahead, Scott.
I have a very simple question. Would you recommend this book to a fellow sci-fi reader?
Wow. I think I recommended it to Dan, so...
No.
Sorry,
I mean, I keep reading... Despite the fact that apparently I don't care for a lot of his books, I keep reading them. And every time he comes out with a new one, I'm like, I'll put that down on my list. Because he's interesting. This is what I said. I'm not necessarily enjoyable, but interesting.
But you wouldn't recommend it to somebody else.
I in fact, anti-recommended it to someone the other day. So I guess that answers your question.
Did you just smack them?
How do you anti-recommend something?
I said, don't read this book.
Don't read this book and buy this one from me.
No, I keep it on my bookshelf as a, you know, a badge of honor.
Or as a warning to the other books, yes.
A reminder.
I recommended this book to my wife, who does not read lots of science fiction, and she, in fact, is just about to finish it. So I'm speaking to you from the living room couch where I'll be sleeping for the next week. No.
She's still your wife, so that's good news.
She seems to be enjoying it. It's out of her comfort zone, but I think I think she appreciates it because it's so different and there's a lot of interesting stuff in it. But she's not a regular sci-fi reader. So I think from her perspective, it's kind of interesting to have the ideas of 18 different sci-fi novels packed into one.
It's like a brief history of science fiction.
It's a variety
of
fun
concentrated science fiction.
Yeah.
Just add water.
A master's class, perhaps.
I would recommend this to someone who has a tolerance for reading or – and being involved with
tolerance the third, for reading.
No, all right. Let me tell you. I'm gonna give you
what am I, a key fan?
As just to use the theme of this, let's use the theme of this novel. My esteemed colleague Jeff Carlson and my wife Flynn and I went to a dance performance several years ago, and it was so incomprehensible and bad, but well executed. We were angry. People were walking out in the middle of singing, angrily standing up during this performance. People running around the stage and playing off tune music, and were leaving the theater. I don't know how many times I've ever seen that. And we left, and we were so angry about it, and we talked about it, and why we were angry about it, how awful it was, and we hated it, even though it was very well done. And I have the same sort of feeling about this novel, not quite as angry, but I would recommend it to somebody who wanted to experience a range of emotions on reading and want to be exposed to a lot of interesting ideas, but who would, you know, it's a, you might be ultimately completely unsatisfied with how this holds up as a novel.
I have to say there's a certain, I don't want to say perverse satisfaction, but, you know, there is something for me to, I feel like often I like a lot of, or like everything to a certain extent. Like I'm very tall, I very, you know, I'll watch terrible movies and say, yeah, there was some redeeming value to that or whatever. And sometimes I think like, oh, maybe I'm not critical enough. So it was refreshing for me to find a book that I could read that I'm like, did not like this. And I mean, but it's still, you know, in ways that made me think critically about what it was I did not like about it. And I think there's a value to that. There's a value to reading something that you disagree with.
Yes.
And thinking, well, why did I not like this? Or what was it about this I did not find appealing?
And we all agree he's a fabulous, I mean, he's a very interesting, thoughtful writer with an enormous number
absolutely
of ideas. So none of
absolutely
us think this is not a poorly written novel. It just no doesn't hold together in the way that we want something that's satisfying to. But, and he'll write, you know, he'll write more that does and does not.
Of course, Scott and I seem to like it, so.
That's true. I really did enjoy it, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
There you go.
And in fact, my wife was like, oh, should I read that Embassy Town book that you said you liked so much? I said, read City in the City.
Yes.
Yeah, well, and that's what I told my friend when we were talking about Chime Infill, and he, in fact, disliked him more than I did. And I said, well, you know, if you're going to read one, read The City in the City and not Embassy Town.
I'd agree with that. Even I, who enjoyed Embassy Town a lot, would agree that The City in the City is better.
And it's yes much more accessible.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah. Well, you know what you're seeing is a noir kind of detective story, even though it's got its strange spin, and so it's a little more recognizable. Yeah.
You're marrying the weirdness with something that is understandable. And I think that's a good combination.
And it's not the very language itself is not fighting you, which is helpful.
Well, some of it is, but not so much. It seems it's
not
just. You feel like you turned your head like 3 degrees away from normal, as opposed to you know.
Right. It's kind of out of phase, but not actively punching you.
Actively punching you.
So now it comes time on our podcast for us to answer that musical question. What are you reading, Dan? What are you reading?
I am reading A Dance with Dragons, actually, because it's really long and it's taking me some time because I don't get as much opportunity to read as I would like. So the latest George R. R. Martin book, I'm only like a couple hundred pages in, I think, and there's like
800,000
to go or something. I don't know.
There's a lot of pages.
It's interesting so far, although part of me feels like I'm reading it out of obligation. I'm waiting for it to pick up. But the problem for me is also that I read the previous book when it came out, you know, 6 years ago.
Yeah. We'll have to have a whole podcast on that book. I just finished it myself.
I had to go reread, you know, the Wikipedia recap pages and everything. Like, all right, where were we in this massive story? It's like people keep trying to convince me that after Robert Jordan passed away, the guy who took over writing Wheel of Time, like, oh, those books are actually pretty good. I'm like, yeah, but I stopped reading like halfway through that series, which means there's like 4 or 5 books I got to get through that you've already admitted to me are basically crap. So, yes.
All right.
Enjoying it so far, but looking for other interesting things to read.
Anything else you've read recently? I guess Embassy Town was the most recent, huh?
Yep. Before that, I reread a classic, A Princess of Mars, Edgar Rice Burroughs, in preparation for, there is a John Carter movie coming out next year, I believe.
Yes, indeed.
Friday Night Lights in Space.
I had never read, any of his stuff and thought it interesting, very reminiscent, of course, of stuff of that era. But interesting. I enjoyed it.
All right. Scott, what are you reading?
That is a good question. I am reading the second book in this trilogy. The book is called The Unincorporated War, which is a sequel to a book called The Unincorporated Man. And the next book of the trilogy is called The Unincorporated Woman. I know, they love the word unincorporated. And it's
not trademarked. Are they anti, I believe that's
are
why.
Are they anti-business?
They are... Well, it's an that's an interesting question, Dan, because so points to
I didn't mean for it to be, but hey.
Well, I know, but sometimes it works out. So it's set in the future, like maybe 400 years into the future, where it's kind of like a libertarian's dream. Corporations run the galaxy – well, not the galaxy, but the star system, and everyone – when you're born, you are incorporated, so you have stock. You have 100,000 shares of stock in yourself. And upon birth, 5% of it is given to the government, 20% of it is given to your parents, and then the rest you can sell to on the open market. And so people own stock in other people, and the whole system is based on whoever owns the majority in you gets to tell you what to do, and generally it's a corporation, so they send you off to like Neptune or whatever they want to do with you.
As you do.
And then so the people in this time period want to earn enough money so they can have a majority of themselves and they can do whatever they want. And in the first chapter of The Unincorporated Man, there's a tunnel, and there's this guy digging in this tunnel because that's his job, because a tunneling company owns the majority of his stock. And he comes across this black cube that he doesn't know what it is, and it turns out it's a cryogenic suspension thing. And inside is Justin Cord, who is the unincorporated man. He's from 350 years ago. He comes into the system. And he was a billionaire, and so he makes some trouble, and hilarity ensues.
All right, and then sequel will be The Unincorporated City Limits.
I quite enjoyed the unincorporated dog.
That's the kid's book.
The Unincorporated Illustrated Man.
That's right. Sea Spot Incorporated.
No, C-Spot signed paper.
Bad spot.
Disbanding
no
corporation.
Biscuits.
I'm holding up the limited liability man myself.
That's excellent.
But it's good.
Glenn, what are you reading?
What am I reading? Can I mention a comic book series?
Yes.
No.
Is that reading?
No.
I'm a little bit behind on this, but
that is not reading.
I've been sort of following the whole – have we done a podcast on the Darkest Night, Brightest Day DC Comics arc?
Green Lantern? Arc. No, we haven't.
Greenland, with disgust. I fell into it by getting some bound anthologies of...
I thought you already told us this one. Didn't you already mention this in another podcast?
Is this a repeat?
Well, no, I just... I think
so. Are you still
because
reading Green
I just
Lantern comics, Glenn?
No, Blackest Night was all collected, and I read it and thought it was slightly incomprehensible, but sort of interesting, and way too many colors in the Green Lantern spectrum nonsense.
Too many colors, right? That's my favorite review ever. Of Green Lantern. My favorite review ever of Green Lantern. Too many colors.
Too many colors.
Isn't it just green?
Oh, Scott.
Oh, no.
Apparently, I'm an idiot.
What are you, some sort of unincorporated man?
I'm also colorblind.
You're smarter than the DC Comics universe, I'm afraid. Every color.
They're all gray to me. The Green Lantern.
It's emotion.
So you moved on from Blackest Night to Brightest Day?
Brightest Day, yeah, which the series ended, I think it was in April, and I've been reading with online comics, so I don't think all of them were, I don't think many of them were day and date, but they're not that far behind. So I just finished sort of the 24 comic arc. I'm not sure I even read all of them. And again, it's a fascinating thing because there's leaping across different books, and there's Dead Man, who's always liked the Dead Man character, Boston Brand, the circus aerialist who dies, is shot, and then has to sort of roam as a ghost and do quantum leap, like helping people to wind up, somehow redeeming his soul from Krishna. A very interesting, weird little character. So he's our hero, anti-hero, and it's a weird little story arc. And again, it's like, I'm not quite sure. It's sort of quasi-religious, and it gets very Captain Planet-y, and I don't know, DC... is now, then after this, of course, they did this whole enormous multi-year arc, and then they've blown up the universe with the reboot anyway. So I have no idea what's going on in the DC Comics universe at all.
All right.
That's what I was reading.
But you're reading it.
Well, apparently, yeah, but after the end of, you know, what, isn't it the summer that everything changes? Everything
yes.
changes.
Everything yes, changes again.
Jason, what are you reading?
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for caring.
I do care.
Is it a comic book?
No. It is not. I've just finished Dance with Dragons. So we can talk about that on a forthcoming podcast, perhaps. I have next to me here, in fact, I have The Wise Man's Fear by Patrick Rothfuss, which I was complaining to my wife that it's out in hardcover and it's huge and, you know, it's a $30 hardcover, but the Kindle version is even $15. And I thought, I don't want to read it that badly. And she said, you know, you could get it for free at the library. And so I came home today and the library copy of The Wise Man's Fear is sitting right here. So I guess I'm going to read a paper book, guys.
And other people have touched it.
I'm frightened.
You should wear gloves.
It's heavy. It's very heavy.
You might get paper cut.
It's mostly human skin.
That's right. Yikes.
You can't see me cringe, but I am.
And the other book that I read recently, in July I went to the last space shuttle launch in Florida. Nothing like Florida in July. Woo! Yeah, that's some humidity. And on the way there, I read a memoir by a guy named Mike Mullane, who is a shuttle astronaut, called Riding Rockets. And it is a very forthright and humorous and somewhat dirty memoir of what it was like to be a space shuttle astronaut, including how he's very open about the fact that he and several of his fellow astronauts were sexist pigs to the first group of women astronauts, and how in the end the women gave as good as they got and educated many of these arrested development astronauts about what it was like to work with women in a professional environment. So there's some good stuff in there. A lot of stuff about Challenger, because the group of astronauts that he trained with included the Challenger astronauts. It's a really, really great story. A lot of fun. Our friend and coworker Shali McFarland actually recommended it to me, and it's quite good. So, Riding Rockets by Mike Mullane was my little shot of nonfiction and amidst the dragons and aliens that look like Zorak from Space Ghost. I also read that astronaut book.
Even when you read nonfiction, it's about space.
Exactly.
That's good. Stick to what you know.
That's what I'm trying. I'm trying to be well-rounded in a completely one-dimensional way. Are there any Zeppelins? Anybody read anything with Zeppelins in it? No?
I started to watch The Rocketeer the other night.
There are Zeppelins.
I was recently in a...
You were in a Zeppelin?
I was in a giant dirigible hangar.
Giant Zeppelin? Oh, hangar.
I was in a dirigible hangar and saw pictures of 8 dirigibles stored inside it during World War II.
I was in the same dirigible hangar, Glenn.
You were. I know, but not at the same time.
No, we were different times.
In Tillamook, Oregon.
I was watching you.
Oh, my God. That was the worst for me.
It's scary. Zeppelin stalkers.
I was listening to some Led Zeppelin.
I was
Zeppelin,
there in the future.
Zeppelin stalkers would be a good name for a band.
The only thing that I...
cover band.
Only thing I came home from Comic-Con with that I paid for... Not sort of the here, have a free piece of crap.
Besides a contagious disease, right?
That was free.
The cold is free. Is a poster from a comic book of a schematic of a Zeppelin, actually, of an airship, a rigid airship. And I thought, I walked up to the guy and I said, I find your illustrations of Zeppelins intriguing, which is the first time I've ever said that to anybody, but not the last.
It's the worst pickup line ever.
Yeah. He said, tell me more. So I bought a Zeppelin picture for
$5. And $5? That's cheap.
That's my... I know.
That's good.
For a Zeppelin picture?
Those could go
upwards. What do those usually go for?
$6.
$6, yeah. On the floor at Comic-Con.
Are you now going to try and build your own Zeppelin?
Shh, don't
using that as a model.
Yes,
exactly.
Using the comic book schematic as a model, I will build my own personal Zeppelin. Actually, my idea is that you what you do is you work a little like mini Zeppelin airbag thing into the roof of your car, and then when you're stopped in traffic, you press the button.
I think Inspector Gadget had
you press the button, it inflates, you rise up above the traffic, your turbofan pops out the back, you go over the traffic jam, back down on, deflate, and go.
That's sure, it's great point. Until everybody's got
That's
one.
My invention. How do you like it? What do you think, sirs?
We've got commercial sign.
Yeah. More Zeppelin. So in the next year, we need to make sure we read a book with Zeppelins in it.
There should be at least 20% more Zeppelin.
We'll always have Zeppelin.
This is the longest I've ever been in a book club, by the way.
Really?
This is the only book club I've ever been in.
It's a whole year, and we occasionally don't read the same things, and other times we do. But so it's an odd book club.
It is an odd book club.
I don't think Oprah would approve.
I never thought about this as a book club before.
She calls it book club every time. Every time.
Glenn.
How many of these have you been on?
Glenn is accidentally in the book club. It was all an oversight.
Which was the part that got away from you, the book or the club?
Oh, this podcast is over. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Scott McNulty, Glenn Fleischman, and Dan Warren. And until next time, when perhaps we will, Glenn will realize he's in a book club.
Dun, dun, dun.
Until then. This is Jason Self for the Incomparable Book Club, signing off.
Wait a second. This is a book club?
This podcast.
Recording.
Glenn and I were synchronized.
Podcast. Anyway.
It's yeah, there's a lot of it's tiny ruined. Little bits in German in the beginning until he forgets to use them anymore.
Yes.
Ba-dum-ba.
Yeah, that you just summarized Embassy Town.
On Embassy Town, they don't use it. It's back in wherever she trained to be a Immer pilot that's the German whatever.
It reminds me, there's a great bit in of German. Old science fiction.
Okay, we should stop.
Okay, wait.
We're recording.
Remind me to bring up the whole thing about the up and out. It's a famous bit of
recording.
The up and out, famous bit of Immer like precursor science fiction, I should mention. Okay.
Not recording.
This is all off the record, right?
All right.
My lawyers have advised me not to record.
Oh, dear. Well, yes, if you try to record me, my voice won't be picked
My lawyers
up.
Have advised me never to appear on this podcast again.
I'm an audio vampire.
You just don't listen to the lawyers, do you?
I think we lost Scott, guys.
Yeah, I got to bring him back.
Didn't mean to interrupt the thread there.
I suddenly
noticed we were down a man.
Down a man.
Perhaps he answered his door unwisely.
He's in the Immer.
He did answer his door.
I did. I am dead. I don't know what happened. It was very strange.
Did you rip off your hearing limbs?
I'm about to rip off some hearing limbs.
Did you guys catch the Dawn of the Dead reference in there, by the way? The last thing you would ever expect in a China Mieville novel is a reference to George Romero's Dawn of the Dead. In this highfalutin novel, they were watching basically a George Romero zombie movie film festival as they prepared for death.
And that little bit would, I will say, if you want to read a zombie book, read this book instead of Feed.
Yes, just for that. Well, the guys, after they rip off their little ear stalks, they're kind of like zombies, aren't they? Sort of.
Very rational zombies, though.
Way better than Feed.
Yes.
Wow. Yes. That's a book apparently I don't want to read. Or maybe I do want to read it. I haven't figured this out yet.
I would mulch up Feed and use it to grow things in your backyard ate while eating Embassy Town. How about that?
Let's not advocate destruction of books. Maybe a little bit beyond
If it's
the pale.
A library book, you should return it to your library.
That's true.
If you
recommend them.
If you purchased it, perhaps you should also return it to your library.
Oh, no. That will confuse everyone.
No, don't do that. And if it's on your Kindle, do not throw away your Kindle. Just delete the book.
No, just send it to Scott. He'll take it. That's He'll take care of it for you.
Send your Kindle at a self-addressed stamped envelope, too.
Scott is the Kindle whisperer. He can talk to it and get it, you know,
clock it off the ledge. I know Feed was loaded on you, but it's okay. It's okay. There are other books out there. Feed won't be loaded on you forever.
Feed will be loaded.
So come
forever.
On, come on back. It's okay. We're all okay.
It's got his finger hovering over the permanent destruction button in its firmware. I'm gonna do it.
Kindle's gonna jump in the swimming pool. Don't. You have so much to live for.
I'm gonna press
There's
the
so
white
many
button.
Good books.
No, I can't take it.
This is taking on a very strange.
It is. I'm uncomfortable. I can name that tune.
What are you reading?
Ooh, we have a jingle.
And no, we don't. We just have Dan and I singing it badly.
Separately. Totally different melodies. Okay. Yeah. This is not a music podcast.
It's only been a year. By the end of year two, we'll all be dead. But then we'll have a jingle.
Don't answer your door. Don't answer your door.
It's a beholder.
Recording. This recording is over.